Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
It's another Saturday night. I am Josh Hadley. With me, as always, is Sarah Hanley.
Hello!
Well, I was drug out. And, as usually always with me, is Glenn Criddle from the UK.
Good night here.
That's Australian, isn't it?
I know it is, yes. I thought I'd confuse you a little bit.
Okay there, Crocodile Gandhi. So, before we get into tonight's show, which will be an extension of last week's show, which was about the copyright bullshit, it'll still be about copyright, but not trolls, what I want to say is, you guys need to go to adamandeve.com. Use the promo code STATIC, and you would get 10 free gifts on top of whatever you order. You'd get a free mystery gift, a gift for him, a gift for her, free U.S. shipping, sorry, Glenn, and 6 free DVDs on top of whatever you order that'll probably go on top of or inside you. Just use the promo code STATIC at adamandeve.com. Now, see, what I just did there isn't copyrighted. Hell, these shows aren't technically copyrighted. I put them up as sort of free form. As long as you credit 1201 Beyond and you don't make any money off of it, I don't care if you use these shows in something else, because I have open copyright. I know Lloyd Kaufman is kind of the same way with all of Troma's products. But most companies are not. Most companies protect their copyright, right or wrong, like they're fighting over the last scrap of bread in the middle of a hunger strike. Glenn, do you think copyright has, as it's legally enforced, is too stringent and too ridiculous?
Yeah, I think the remit for what seems to be considered copyright is absolutely insane. It's got to the point now where if anything sounds vaguely like another thing or looks vaguely like another thing, that you're at desperate risk of ending up in a court. And there's been some very high-profile examples of that just recently, which I'm sure we'll get into a little bit later. But it has gotten to the point that these companies are so rabidly desperate to look after their product that they will kind of just go for absolutely anything which seems to be vaguely within their remit, and stuff which is, you know, I don't even know how to describe it. It's such an amorphous thing that these companies are throwing out there and saying, that's our copyright, this other thing is our copyright. It's so hard to keep track of. I don't know how anybody dares to release, publish, film anything these days without, you know, facing the risk of ending up in court.
Sarah, do you agree with that, or do you being the youngin among us, what are your thoughts on copyright as it stands? Because copyright in your lifetime has always been this stringent. Glenn and I, not so much.
I think that it needs to have some sanity into it. Copyright changes between physical locations on Earth, and you have situations where some companies will go after anything. You have Toho with anything that looks like a giant lizard or has the word Zilla on it. You know, even if it's part of a word, you have Mozilla went up against them because they went, no, people confuse that with Godzilla, because you're going to confuse an internet provider with a giant city stomping monster. I really don't see the basis in that.
Actually, I do kind of see a metaphor there that they might not have intended.
Well, true. But some sanity would be great, because in some areas of the world, people feel pressure to go after anything that kind of looks like what they do. And there are some companies that they go after either fan interpretations, which most of the time, 90 plus percent of the time, they're not making any money off of it. It's a way for people to go, I like this thing and I want to share it with other people. And then you go after these people who aren't making any money, who are bringing more attention to what you have made. There's many levels that can be shot down on. And then you have the people who do it under parody. And technically in the United States, parody is covered under fair use. There are a lot of companies that are ignoring that. There are places like where Glenn is, where that's not quite as solid a case. You have the those stupid little, I think they were Moshi monsters, that you had singers who were going, well, this one is making fun of me, and so I'm taking you to court and take that character down. It's a freaking character in a Flash game. It is. No one is going to think that that is, I'm throwing out a name here just randomly, Christina Aguilera, that she's actually a pink dinosaur. But if you do, you need to cut down on the drugs a little.
But there is a line between parody and plagiarism. For instance, the first Shinobi video game that Sega put out, one of the villains was Zilla, and it was a giant lizard that looked almost exactly like Godzilla. One of the villains was Man-Spider, who looked exactly like Spider-Man. Another one was Bat with two T's dash Man, looked exactly like Batman. They meant it as parody, but because they were making so much profit off of it, and these things were so damn close, I actually think Sega did screw up on that one, and they crossed the line from parody into plagiarism.
Oh, yeah.
There's always a line.
I mean, there's that great, I think, one of the lovely Turkish films where you have Spider-Man shooting people. You know, that's an awesome thing to watch. You know that is crossing the line.
Well, no, in Turkey, when it comes to those, and Glenn, I know you've probably encountered these, there's a difference there. Turkey in the 1970s didn't recognize copyright in any way. Nothing in Turkey could be copywritten. So they saw everything that came to Turkey the same way. So those weren't technically copyright infringement because there was never copyright to begin with. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I think one of the other things was in countries like Turkey, there was a real problem with them getting the original films in. It was too expensive for them to get them in, so they made cheap knockoffs, which is probably why the copyright laws in part were kind of how they were. As I understand it, I don't know how factual that is, but that's one of the considerations I believe was responsible for that situation.
Well, let's go back to, and Glenn, I don't know how much you know about British copyright laws, so I don't know how much this will differ for you, but if it does, I'd like to hear it. Mm-hmm. The way copyright law in America started was very reasonable. It was 27 years from the creation of whatever the work was. You got to remember, when this was originally instituted, TV and radio didn't exist yet. So this was from the written work, the cartoon, the comic, whatever. 27 years, you've got 27 years to make whatever you're going to make off of it. Then it belongs to everybody. Then they changed it. And again, I don't think this was completely unreasonable, to the lifetime of the creator. So when the artist, writer, whoever dies, then it becomes public domain, that they have their lifetime to do it. Their kids can fend for themselves. Then it became the lifetime of the creator plus 25 years. All right, we're getting a little bit ridiculous. Then it became life of the creator plus 100 years. Then 127 years. And then you get into the sticky situation of, what is a movie, though? Who is the creator of a movie? Who's the creator of a horror film? Is it the director, the writer, or the studio? If it's the studio, then as long as the studio stays around, then life of the creator could be 600 years, couldn't it? Do you see how this got more and more ridiculous as the movie studios specifically started to gain higher and higher control, and they didn't want to lose their stuff after 20X years? Because let's face it, Mickey Mouse should be public domain. The old Universal Monsters should be public domain, but Universal and Disney are horrified about what would happen if these things ever fall into the public domain, which they should have many, many years ago. Glenn? It doesn't matter. Whoever's next, then.
Go for it, Sarah.
Well, and when we're looking at this, they're scared that the mouse is going to go public domain. And the thing, when you're describing this to a person, they go, okay, I understand. You don't want Mickey Mouse to go public domain. But it's not even the Mickey Mouse of now. The Mickey Mouse that would go into public domain and should have already is only the Steamboat Willie version, because it's not like this is as soon as its toe crosses the line, then everything is public domain. It's everything is public domain as of the date of that creation. So the Steamboat Willie one would go first, and then the shorts would go next, and then you would go into things that were later on. There is a logic to this, and they do overblow it just so that people think, oh no, they're a wonderful company and they shouldn't lose that. Companies are not people. These creations took so much from the public domain, and that they don't fall back into it. I know that we're not talking about things like medications, but I think that that does apply, in that you have all of these medications that were made from public funds in publicly funded universities, and then people were able to put patents on them, and then they're able to reap all the profits from that, when the creation of these things that make them tons of money came from not only the work of the country and the world as a group, but the funding. These things come from somewhere. If you don't replenish that, you're going to be very rich and no one else is going to be able to make anything. And I know that they don't see that as a bad thing. It's just horrible for humanity as a group.
What do you think, Glenn? Do you agree with Sarah?
For my money, the idea of who actually holds the copyright really does. I mean, it needs standardizing in some respects. When it comes to films and stuff like that kind of thing, there's a reason that films are usually credited to a director. It's normally the first person you think of when you think of the creation of a film, not the studio. You don't go, oh, it's a Paramount film, or it's a Universal film. You go, it's a David Lynch film, or it's a Christopher Nolan film, or whatever.
I'm not so sure I agree with you on that. Because a lot of people, like, when most people think of Dracula, they think of Universal's Dracula. They don't go Todd Browning's Dracula. They don't go James Whale's Frankenstein. They say Universal's Frankenstein. Universal's Dracula.
But they say Boris Karloff.
That's true.
Anna.
I don't know. I mean, maybe that's a sign of the time that those were particularly made. But I think these days you don't tend to think of those, the studio entity as being the owner of the film, the creator of the film. And when you're talking about a creative team for something like a film, obviously you've got hundreds of people who are involved with any given film. So you tend to centralize it down to one person, and it's usually the director. Rather, even above the writer, you know, rightly or wrongly, it's the director who tends to be considered the author of the film. So, I mean, for my money, when it comes to films, I think it really ought to be the director's life who's kind of considered the copyright period, if you will. And I'm happy, you know, in some respects, to say, you know, the copyright holder's life plus 25 years or something like that. Because, you know, you've got like Kubrick, who was making films up to, you know, his death. I can't imagine it would be fair on the family for him to have just completed a film and then, you know, suddenly it's in the public domain. So, you know, there's checks and balances which need to be considered. But I don't think when it comes to the life of the before it becomes public domain shouldn't be related to something like the studio, because it's not a person, it's not the creative entity, it's the business end of it, it's the financial infrastructure that goes behind the film. So in that respect, I don't think copyright should be necessarily ascribed to that entity. It's never as simple as saying one thing or the other. There has to be kind of checks and balances to some degree. But
I absolutely agree. But what about when you transfer? For instance, let's go to the old G.I. Joe cartoon that was made by Sunbow, who went out of business and sold all of their properties to somebody else. So then does that mean the copyright for Life of the Creator, shouldn't that have been when Sunbow went out? Or how are you able to transfer these? Do you see how fucked up this all gets when you deal with transferring and who holds the license? I mean, for example, right now, James Bond. I don't know who distributes in the UK. Would that still be MGM? MGM holds it here.
Yeah, so same over here.
Well, the character of James Bond is now public domain in Canada. According to Canadian copyright law, anyone can make a James Bond film, make a James Bond TV series, write James Bond stories, because the character and the setting is public domain. But then you run into the problem, well, MGM owns it in America and England, so if Canadians made a James Bond movie, they would get sued by MGM if they tried to distribute it outside of Canada. So then you've got different countries with different laws. And that's not even getting into the Italians in the 70s, which, Glenn, I know you know all about.
Yeah.
So we'll get into that in a minute. But, Sarah, what do you think this means with Canada and James Bond?
Well, I think it means the same thing as Peter Pan in England, because Peter Pan is public domain everywhere except for England. It was a declaration of the Queen. I don't know which Queen. I figured that you'd switch them out every 5 years or so. And it is perpetually not in public domain in England, because all of the profits go to a certain orphanage that I guess you guys still have. Maybe just so that they can get the checks from Peter Pan. But I was wondering about that when you have that incredibly insipid TV show that's still on, when they announced that Peter Pan's characters were going to be on there. I went, are they just not going to show that in England, or is Disney going to make some sort of deal? It's Disney. They have oodles of money, so... Yeah.
They'll throw some cash at it and the problem will go away, basically, because they can do that. But it is an interesting part of the problem. We're living in this global society. Everything, all these massive film companies are trying to globalize and take advantage of the global market. And you hear it with all corporations where they're going, yeah, you know, globalization, it's great, it's great, it's great. And then they want to control how it sort of happens. And then you've got the interests of the various different countries, the different copyright laws. It's slightly different in England to America. It's very different in Spain. I've been doing some research on Spanish copyright law, which is just insane, in my opinion. wherever you go, it's very different. And I do, you know, anecdotally, I remember going over to Dubai, quite a long time ago, and we walking into shops that were labeled up as Billboard, as in the music company, and going in there, there's pirated copies of just about everything in those places. So copyright law in Dubai, apparently, at least at the time, seemed to mean absolutely shag all.
Well, and you have in Japan, you have this entire subculture of doujinshi, which is people taking things that are already out there and making their own comic books of them. It would be like Ashcan editions over here. I'm guessing you have Ashcans there, because I don't know if you do. And then that there's entire meetups of people who sell these at tables, and they're able to become better artists, and they're able to make a little bit of money as they're becoming better artists. And that's one of those things that I wish we had over here, just because it's a way of showing, hey, I'm really good at drawing this. You want to hire me to draw my own things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay under Japanese copyright law, but one of the problems with the Pan Pacific partnership is that they want to have the most stringentest, I cannot say words, copyright laws all the way across the world, and make everybody handcuffed and incredibly unhappy. So not the good kind of handcuffs, the bad kind of handcuffs.
Yeah, you know, I mean, this is the thing, the whole kind of issue that we've got at the moment. I mean, maybe it will sort some shit out if it did happen. Well, everything I've heard about the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, whatever, has seemed pretty negative, certainly on that front. But there is this massive problem that we have, the internet, which is this open forum for putting stuff out there and sharing it, and you're taking a risk every time you do it. Even when you upload to YouTube, you've got the problems with various different countries' copyright laws that you're having to deal with. It's madness, you know. And this is the thing: to sort this out, you have to literally change the world. Where the fuck do you start?
When are you going to get the whole world to agree on one single thing? Josh, how are you going to do that?
You're not. That's the problem.
No, you're not
going to get the world to agree on anything.
Can we agree here, at least, you know? might just start a little revolution.
Well, what it really comes down to is, should we change the way that they are now? Do you think there's a chance, because it just keeps getting worse, is there a chance that this can get better? Or do you think it's just going to get more and more stringent, like with when SOPA was being introduced? What they were trying to do with SOPA to give the movie studios complete control over the internet. Glenn?
I think at the moment it certainly it seems that there's some pretty powerful players trying to push it in the wrong direction, and this is one of the bad parts of globalization, really, is that these corporations want to be able to have all the pie and eat it, and that's not a healthy thing for anyone in the world, wherever you are. I said it last week, the thing with culture, whether it be the kind of movies that you and I watch, whether it's mainstream culture, whether it's theatre or books or music or whatever, the progression of it is dependent on us being able to take this stuff and make it our own and reuse it. Because there is very, very, very little that you could describe as even a small part original. It's all about, because we build upon the stuff that we've experienced, the stuff that we love, and that influences what we put out. Yeah, there's plagiarism. I think it's a lot grayer area than some people would necessarily want to admit. But I don't think a lot of the time it's necessarily theft. It's sometimes just expression.
Well, now, at what point does expression become plagiarism? Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, you know, for instance, the Blurred Lines verdict. Now, mm-hmm. I could hear in that song the Marvin Gaye music, and it was, to me, they plagiarized it. Robin Thicke and Pharrell plagiarized it. But the entire music industry is saying, if this is considered plagiarism, then the whole music industry itself is doomed, because mm-hmm. there are only so many riffs you can make without sounding like somebody else. They're saying that the Blurred Lines verdict is setting a dangerous precedent. I'm not so sure. Because, you know, look at like the James Cameron Harlan Ellison thing. You get to a certain point where it is copying. It's not inspired by. It's the same thing. Blurred Lines and Marvin Gaye's song were the same thing. Yes, Blurred Lines sped it up a little bit and they added a little bit more bass. But that's like trying to say, no, see, Ice Ice Baby really isn't Under Pressure because there's one extra didn't in there. Instead of dent 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 dent, it's dent 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 dent. So it's not the same thing. And it's like, no, there is a point where it's too close. That doesn't mean you can't have free expression. It doesn't mean you can't independently come up with the same idea. It's that there gets to a point where you were stealing this.
I mean, with the Blurred Lines thing, I have a slightly different take on it. I looked at listened to those two tracks, and I can see inspiration from one into the other. But they are two very different things. I mean, if you overlay them, they don't sound the same. Aside from the bass line having the same kind of character and the fact that he was singing in a high voice, and there was certain kind of ambience which was going on in, like the crowd noise and that kind of thing, which has happened in many, many, many other songs. I didn't see them as big copies of each other.
I heard the same tempo. I heard that they both have electric piano. They're both the same beat. They're both the same tempo, and they both have the same pits and spikes. It was the same thing, except Blurred Lines sped it up.
You could probably find several other songs that do the same. For me, this is just, you know, my personal take on the two things, but I didn't think the two were the same.
I don't disagree with you that you can probably find many that are the same. At the same time, many of the other ones who might be somewhat the same don't say one of our biggest influences is Marvin Gaye. That's where you cross the line from inspiration to we stole it. You know, just like with James Cameron and Harlan Ellison. One of my favorite authors is Harlan Ellison. Oh, gee, everything I stole was from Harlan Ellison. Get to a point where it goes beyond inspiration into plagiarism.
It's a very difficult line to define. And that's part of the reason why all the laws are very gray. When you look at copyright law, it's not specific. It doesn't prescribe exactly what qualifies as being plagiarism or theft. And that's the tricky line that we have to sort of ride when we're doing stuff on YouTube and that kind of stuff. But I think plagiarism for me has to be a much closer, a much more demonstrable thing than those, like bringing up again, Blurred Line and the Marvin Gaye song. I think the two worst, in my head at least, you know, rightly or wrongly, maybe it's just my kind of musical ear, which isn't particularly brilliant. But I think the two were sufficiently different to not be carbon copies. There was a lot of talk when they were going on about this band, the character and the tone and the flavour of the music, if you like, being very, very similar. And yes, they are. There is a lot of, there's an obvious influence there. But I can't say as if I heard one of them and heard the other. That would confuse the two. They seem to have something different going on. That's a very difficult thing to describe, I guess. You know exactly what it is that's actually different about it. But there is something different going on in there.
And see, I don't agree with you. You're entitled to your opinion. Or the way I like to put it, you're entitled to be wrong. So, Sarah, where do you weigh in on this? Are you weighing in with me or Glenn? And you don't have to weigh in with me because I'm the one that brought you here. I want honest opinions.
Okay, honestly, I have not listened to this song a lot because I listened to some of it and I was like, wow, I don't like this in my ears. Take it away. But one of my favorite song overlays And it's not easy to as easy to find this on YouTube anymore. And it's the only place where I can find it is you take Smooth Criminal and you lay it over with Ghostbusters, and they hit at the same points a lot of the times. I think one of them has to be sped up a little.
So but at that point, would Huey Lewis get to sue?
Yeah.
if they did that now, it absolutely would.
You are aware that Huey Lewis sued Ray Parker Jr. and won for plagiarizing Ghostbusters, right?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's what my joke was, because Ghostbusters is already a plagiarized song legally in court. So if you're saying Smooth Criminal's in there, it's like, Christ, did Huey Lewis write all the hits accidentally? I Want a New Drug came before or after Smooth Criminal. I think after, but I might be wrong.
Well, the question
this
is,
the crux of the matter?
Would the news be brought in as witnesses?
I'm not sure. But then, you know, you've got stuff like Candy Crush, that horrendous Candy Crush saga. This is how far weird American copyright law has gotten. Candy Crush Saga is a blatant ripoff of a game that came out 2 years earlier called Candy Swipe. It's the exact same thing. Exact same game. Candy Crush Saga stole this and completely plagiarized it, and then sued the developers of Candy Swipe, saying, now that we're more popular, we need to make sure people don't confuse your game, which came first, with our much more popular game, so you need to stop making your game because we ripped you off so effectively. They actually are going to court over this. Have we gotten to the point where the ripoff artist can sue the original for saying, you're too close to what I stole from you?
Well, they did that already with Banner Saga. They didn't get all the way through with it because they are stupid evil. If you're going to be evil, be effective evil. Don't be stupid evil. I have no respect for you then.
If you're going to do something, do it right.
Absolutely.
Glenn, did you hear about the Candy Crush Saga nonsense?
I haven't, but it kind of rings very true of, you know, it's just so many cases where it's kind of the first to claim dibs. And that's such a shitty position to find ourselves in, this whole thing where the person who claims dibs and has the most money to be able to defend that gets to claim the right, and it's frustrating in the extreme. Now I kind of wish hopes, dreams that it was possible to be able to take inspiration and to be able to run with that kind of stuff. Because I think it's important, culturally speaking, for our cultural growth to be able to kind of build upon other works and all that kind of stuff.
And go ahead.
Yeah, I think when people come along and start essentially pissing on the post to mark their territory, it's killing kind of creativity. People just cannot come up with ideas for fear that either somebody else is going to go and trump them in court and say, well, you know, you weren't fast enough to get the copyright in, or, you know, it's madness. It's really, really frustrating. And quite frankly, I just want to punch a wall right now.
Well, you also have – now, I don't know if this was just bluster on his part or if he actually would do it. But like Harlan Ellison said about the Terminator case, that if – he said if James Cameron had come to him and said, hey, I've got this idea. It's based on some of your works, but I want to take it into another direction. He says, I would have said, fine, just make sure I get a credit and do what you got to do. Whether he's just saying that in retrospect or he would have actually done it, who knows? But there's also the copyright law has gotten so ridiculous nowadays that we're going to go into territory where Glenn and I are arguably experts here. So, Sarah, I definitely want your side as the outsider here. The 70s Italian exploitation. That only could have happened from about 1974 to 1983. Do you think in the modern age, and no, I do not consider the Asylum the same thing, that you could have the Italian exploitation boom the way it happened in the 70s today with how everybody is getting sued today? Because I can only think of one single instance in the entire Italian exploitation boom where an actual lawsuit was filed, and that was due to straight up plagiarism. It would be 1980s Great White, aka The Last Shark, which copied Jaws note for note and even used a good quality of its music, so Universal had no choice but to sue. But do you think the Italian exploitation boom of that era could happen in today's copyright environment, Glenn?
Almost definitely not. And what a shame it would have been if the situation now had existed then. Most of the films that I've reviewed in the last 5 years, I would not have been able to review because they would have been sued into oblivion. And let's face it, there's some great, great films which have come out of there, and not films that you would necessarily confuse with the original, shall we say, inspiration.
I don't know. You get some, like the Bruno Mattei stuff, where you go, this is Predator. It just has a robot instead of an alien, but it's the exact same film.
But it's not really impacted upon the original movie, and that's the thing. It's a separate entity. It's a very separate entity. People don't look at that and go, oh, yeah, you know, I'm going to watch that instead of Predator. It's just not going to happen. And this is the thing. You've got this cultural icon that people draw inspiration from and, you know, to some extent plagiarize. But nobody's going to kind of look at that and go, oh, yeah, well, you know, that's clearly kind of the one we're going to watch out because, you know, I'm not going to watch that big Hollywood production that's actually, you know, 100 times more agreeable.
Hey, 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 did you just backhandedly badmouth Reb Brown? You watch that shit, Brett. Reb Brown's man.
Would I ever?
I hope not.
But he's just upset that he never played Captain Britain, you know.
Well, he was Captain America! But yeah, okay, Sarah, you being the kind of... You're not as deep into this underground well as Glenn and I tend to swim. What do you think... And you know which ones we're talking about, all the Road Warrior ripoffs and the Alien ripoffs and Star Odyssey and all this crap. Could that type of movement make it today? Because... Like I said, a lot of people consider The Asylum kind of a modern day that, and if they do, then they don't know their Italian exploitation from their ass. But in today's copyright climate, could that kind of a movement last for almost a decade?
It couldn't last for a decade. I think that the closest that we have now is the crowd-funded fan film. An example I'll give is There Will Be Brawl, which I thought was well done. You're going to see all of the edges of where their funding ran out, but the story was good enough to make you watch all the way to the end, but still not to the quality of the exploitation films that we had in the past. And it makes me sad. It makes me wish that people who have something to say about subjects, even if they are not allowed to touch those subjects, finger quote, that they would find some way to be able to do that. If we're at the point where people are spending 3 years of weekends in order to put out something that they can't even put up and get any funding legally, or they'll get in trouble and then they'll be sued into oblivion for doing a work that they really needed to get out there, I don't know what to say about the laws. It's not creative friendly. It's not artist friendly. Sighing.
Well, okay. Now you went there, so I'm going to follow with. I'm sure both of you have seen Power / Rangers, right? That Katie Sackhoff, James Vanderbeek fan film.
I'm sorry. I've only read about it.
Have you seen it, Glenn?
No, I read about it. That was the one that was supposedly a lot darker, and
it was a hard R. They said fuck a lot, and there was gore, and Now Saban, who owns the copyright to the Power Rangers, sued to get that film taken off the internet, which it did for a brief period. About 4 days, it was unavailable, and then Saban got such a backlash against this that they said, fine, put it up. Now, they legally not only had the right I enjoyed the film, but Saban legally had the right to go after the filmmakers of this, but at the same time, they should have left it alone. Do you think having the right and knowing when to use it are a different thing? Because all this did is made Saban look terrible. Instead of Saban turning this into a public relations bonanza that they could have to gauge the renewed interest in a Power Rangers movie, which they are currently shopping around to Lionsgate, they used this as how dare you. And that blew up in their face. Do you think more people like, you know, Aliens fan films and Star Wars fan films, because like Star Wars, under George Lucas, you could make fan films. Under Disney, you do it and we're suing you. Do you think that these companies, just because they can, they should, or they should realize when to swing that hammer?
There needs to be certainly a lot more subtlety and thought in when it is that they apply the legal tools. The Power Rangers thing is a very grey area in some respects, but it's not like, again, that anyone's going to confuse that with the official Power Rangers movie, because that already has its own identity. It's that very camp comic book kind of stuff which is going on in those particular originals that people would recognize. People, when they saw that, kind of recognized it as being a fan film. And when it comes to something which has a fan base and a culture which kind of surrounds it, then why not let people do that stuff? I think it's a useful thing for the identity of the product to allow the fan base to be able to express themselves with that material. There's lines that need to be drawn. You can't have somebody making a shit ton of money out of your product. I think, you know, I think there has to be certain caveats which are applied to fan films and third party use of material. If it's something that somebody's put together because they love that particular a franchise or something like that, and it's clearly a fan expression and it's not a massive business venture, then why the hell not? Why not let them do this kind of stuff? As long as it's not physically damaging the product that that Saban owned. I mean, if somebody had come along and made a film which harmed the product's identity, then you might have a certain issue, a certain point.
That was actually what Saban argued, because they said the Power Rangers are a kids' show and aimed at kids. And here you've got people having their arms cut off and blood flying, and they say this thing's like 18 minutes long, and they say fuck almost 30 times and whatnot. That was their argument, that this is damaging the Power Rangers brand.
Yeah, and I would argue against that in terms of how old are the Power Rangers fans these days?
You know? That's true. But then you've got, like I pointed out, when Disney got Star Wars, they shut down fan films. And same with Marvel. There is, from the trailer that I've seen, a fantastic-looking, very expensive, very slick Punisher fan film that Marvel C&D'd. Disney specifically, C&D, that we're never going to see. These people made it because they love the Punisher. And as soon as they announced that they put it out in the trailer, Disney jumped lawyers all over their asses. and they are legally within their rights to do that. Mm-hmm. The question I'm posing to you, Sarah, as a comic fan is, should they have?
I don't think that they should have. For one reason, anytime that you do that, you put more spotlight into the thing that you're trying to imagine doesn't exist. You're trying to wish it out of existence, and by putting a lawsuit against them, not only are you making the possibility that you're going to lose this lawsuit, you're also giving them recognition. You're saying this is a thing that exists out there, and people who don't know about it are going to suddenly know that it is there, and there's going to be more people watching it. And of the Saban Power Rangers thing, that one I'm not happy with. The thing that I'm more not happy with is what they did to a game called Chroma Squad, which was a kickstarted game that was about five actors on a TV show where they played Sentai Rangers, and Saban went after them. And the thing is that they were not, that they said that they had they were inspired by the Japanese Sentai Ranger shows, which Saban took their footage from. Saban is not the one who made that footage. Saban is not the one who created the
Sentai. But Saban is the legal owner of that footage.
No, that they're the legal owner of the Power Rangers and the things that the Power Rangers do. They got their inspiration from the shows in Japan, and they still brought a lawsuit against them, and they did settle. And so now on the box, if there is a physical box, it might just be a download, but it says Chroma Squad inspired by Saban's Power Rangers. And you go, that should not be on there. I understand that it allowed the game to exist because Saban does have lawyers that a tiny little indie studio doesn't have, but man, that has no right to exist because they were taking from the same inspiration that you took from, Saban. And if the company in Japan that was making the Sentai shows and still makes the Sentai shows over there, if they had a problem with it, I would be completely cool with this. Okay, maybe I'm lying, but I would be a lot cooler with it than Saban going, you're stealing from the Power Rangers. No, they're not. Okay, sorry, frustrated.
You're getting a little worked up. All right.
Yeah.
Well, what about when it comes to copyrights on things in the public domain? For instance, like John Carter. John Carter, the character, and all of the original John Carter Warlord of Mars stories, or John Carter of Mars to be more specific, are public domain. But since Disney made their big John Carter disaster, and they're trying to make another reboot, they are not – they legally can't stop you, but they are applying pressure and laying out a chilling effect to anyone else that might have the bright idea of doing something John Carter as well. They're basically saying the character's public domain, but you can't compete with us, and we will make sure you can't compete with us. Somebody wanted to make a John Carter animated series, and the rumor is, this is all just rumor and conjecture at this point, that Disney sent their lawyers down almost thug style, like, are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure you really want to make a John Carter series? We're looking at John Carter stuff. Are you sure you want to compete with us? And like I said, it's all rumor and conjecture, but the John Carter cartoon got shut down after one letter from a Disney lawyer. The character's public domain. To me, that's abuse of copyright.
That sounds like what happened with Peter Pan and the Pirates.
It happens with Tarzan. It happens with Sherlock Holmes. The big companies say, we have the most recognizable version of the characters, so don't you dare try and do anything with them. I mean, hell, the BBC. Is Sherlock Holmes public domain in the UK, Glenn, or is that just in the US where he's public domain?
I think the original stories must be public domain at this point. As for anything else, any kind like, obviously there's the individual creations which would be copyrighted, but I can't imagine that the character is copyrighted now, because it's such an old character now.
Because I know you guys had that Sherlock show, mm-hmm. and I was wondering if that had to go through licensing, or if that was just, hey, we can do what we want. Because, like, I would love for someone in America to make a John Carter TV series that's not Disney and say, you know what? Fuck you, Disney. We're doing it anyway. Now, as long as you don't copy the specific elements that Disney added to the story, then you're free, which is like one of the arguments that legally they're in the right Universal has over Frankenstein. If you have the flat top and the bolts on the neck, that's not from the original story. They added that, so they trademarked that design. So as long as you don't have that version of Frankenstein, you can make your own Frankenstein whatever you want. Same with Dracula. Their Dracula, the iconic Bela Lugosi image, they created that version of Dracula. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. Like with John Carter, if you stick to the elements that are in the stories, if you look at some of the specific things that Disney added that were not in the stories, that they can copyright that version, and they can come after you for that. But like John Carter and Tarzan are public domain, and they need to remain that way.
How many of the Disney princesses fall into public domain? I'm sure that they have their lawyers every night just searching for anyone who comes too close to their, their alterations.
Exactly.
That's the thing, isn't it? Yeah, that's the thing with the Disney stuff. They've taken from an awful lot of very traditional fairy tales and have been notoriously litigious when anybody's tried to make their own versions. You have to be so damn careful not to stray into Disney's creations from the originals. So the only word of advice I'd give there is, if you want to do a version of any of the original fairy tales, go back to the original fairy tales and stick to them as best as you
can. Glenn, did you know that they sue nursery schools for painting the characters without asking permission?
Yeah.
Like on their walls.
Universal sued a Transylvanian theme park because they had a Dracula that looked a little bit too much like the Bela Lugosi Dracula.
Wow.
You know, wow. Transylvania, you know, where the legend comes from.
Mm-hmm. And this is, again, it's me going back to the whole kind of thing that when you've got a product which is right at the forefront of that particular culture, you need to let go a little bit. You can't have a stranglehold on it. And maybe this is one of the tests that need to be kind of applied to these kind of cases is, culturally speaking, how much of an impact has it had? And the more impact it has, I don't know how you'd measure that, you know, legally speaking, but there needs to be a certain amount of leeway for people to be able to draw from that and to build upon that. And there is a difference between being inspired by something and stealing from those things. And that's as gray as the legal terms and conditions can be.
You know what, Glenn?
Mm-hmm.
We got to wrap the show up, but you just gave me the topic for next time, for the next episode's topic.
Well, there you go. I've done part of my work then, haven't I, this week?
That you inspired him.
Yes.
Yes.
Next week, I think we're going to talk about cultural impact, how much pop culture affects culture, and how much culture affects pop culture.
Sounds good.
I think that's interesting. You just put that in my head. So that will be next. That will be the next episode. How's that?
That's all right. I've earned my way then. This week, that's good.
You have. But if people would like to see more of your stuff, where would they go? Where would they encounter the Lampy Man?
I'm still on YouTube. It's Lampyman 101, and I'm on Geek Juice Media as well.
And then, Sarah, if people want to find out just what the hell an Animakian is,
you can find it on DeviantArt. You can find it on 1201beyond.com. You can find it on Facebook. You can find me lurking at your window at night, but, you know, that's off hours.
Yeah, at least you have office hours for that.
Of course.
And you can find me at 1201beyond.com and contact the show at 1201beyond@gmail.com. And guys, we just got a whole bunch of new banner ads, so turn off ad blocker and check out some of the new banner ads. Trust me, they fit the site very, very well. You'll probably actually end up using these banner ads. They're not the smoking ones that we had before. They're not e-cigs any longer.
Lost in the Static is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.